Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight.
Welcome to the Supertone Show.
Dave Edmunds, I Hear You Knocking Live. And that was from the compilation album Here Comes the Weekend, released in the USA on the 24th of May 2005 on the CMG Sony record label. So, welcome to the second special edition of the Supertone Show, which is called...
The Vinyl That Jeff Gave Us.
We've got a really lovely friend called Jeff Bolliott, and... the story goes that we met at a wine conference. What was like a fair, isn't it? It's when all the traders come together in this massive, great big bull ring, didn't
Correct.
It? And we had this rendezvous we'd never met before because he really loves what we do with Starlight and Campbell with our band. So Jeff said, I've got some vinyl I want to give you. So we met this, but we'd never met him before. We'd obviously been in touch a lot, especially with the music. And so we had this kind of like, we know what you look like. We know, and we just met, didn't we? And he handed over this canvas bag, and his wife Rhonda was there as well, full of vinyl that he bought over from the United States for us. And so we've been so busy writing Starlight One and just getting the UK tour together and everything. Anyway, last week we finally managed to delve into it, didn't we?
So we did.
If you missed last week's show, you can go on to vibes.starlight-campbell.com and listen to show one, which is the vinyl that Jeff gave us. Because vinyl is like such a tradition in our house, isn't it?
It certainly
we
is.
We love it. It's yeah. delicious. So we were so honoured and so chuffed, actually. So... So we started off with Dave Edmunds tonight, but I've got to confess that actually it's not the track that we played isn't what we have on the vinyl because you can't get it on...
digital anyway.
No, you can't. So this actual vinyl is a not-for-sale promo copy issued in 1978 from the College Radio Network. And it says, presents Dave Edmunds and Rock Pile featuring Nick Lowe, Billy Bremner and Terry Williams on drums. And actually, in essence, what it is in vinyl is a 30-minute programme featuring a conversation with Dave Edmunds and music from his latest album at the time, Tracks on Wax 4. And the vinyl features a live version of I Hear You Knocking, and it was recorded live on the 24th of October in 78 by WNEWFM. I wish I had an American accent, just like, you know, that deep, you do it, because it's gone.
WNEWFM. And it was recorded at the Bottom Line Club in New York City, where I saw John Mayall and the Blues Breakers.
You did not.
I certainly did, yeah.
Step
with
outside.
Buddy Whittington on guitar. Yeah, no. It was great. Yeah, I was about 2 metres from him.
Hang on. We've been together 10 years and I didn't know that.
Ah, well, there
you
go.
I love that. So I'm
all
still
these
finding
new
out
things,
stuff.
Yeah.
Woo! Wow, how exciting is that? I'd love to. Do you know, that's the thing, you know, when I travel, I just love to go see bands.
Yeah, well, it was absolutely fantastic seeing John Mayall. But anyway, back onto.
Yes.
Because Dave Edmunds has a big history with me. In fact, I've never met the man. But the great thing about it is that when I first got to listening to music, really, was at school. And I was away at boarding school, and we used to have Top of the Pops on illegally, because it was during the time prep was on, i.e. your homework time at night. And everybody used to go to the television room. I'm sure all of them, well, the masters did know because of all the racket that went on, you know, but we used to go and watch TV and used to watch Top of the Pops. And I remember seeing Sabre Dance, which was Love Sculpture.
Of course.
That's right. And that's Dave Edmunds on guitar. And then I bought the single of I Hear You Knocking early in 1970. Right, so when it came out. So this is the thing. So I know Dave Edmunds, and I've always liked him. And I always thought, what a great guitar player. But he's been a bit out there, Dave Edmunds. And the great thing is that he made this resurgence, which not a lot of people did. Of course, Lemmy did, because Lemmy came out with Motorhead round about the time of Punk and New Wave. And Dave Edmunds did a very similar thing, because he wasn't a young man then. You know, he was probably, I don't know, in his 30s, because he was born in the mid-40s, wasn't he? So he actually had this resurgence with Nick Lowe, who also is super cool. And together, you know, because they did Elvis and a Breaking Glass, all those great songs together. But it was an odd thing, because it was sort of juxtaposed against the punk movement, because the punk movement had just sort of gone or happening.
Yeah.
And this was 1978, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You know? So it's like really, really fantastic. But the great thing about Dave Edmunds, I've got an awful lot of time for him because of his guitar sound. He's the consummate professional. And when you listen to the guitar on this, you know, take me outside and give me a fight if you don't think I'm wrong. Come on, let's do it. Because, you know, that guitar sound is fucking great. Great, great, great. And his playing is great. It's tight. The band were always tight, you know. And Girls Talk, you try and cover that. Girls Talk, because we talked about this a few weeks ago on the show. Girls Talk, you try and cover it, you try and play that song. It is really, really tricky, because it's chordally tricky, but also it's not just standard. It sounds like a standard rock and roll pop tune, but it's not, right? And the band are fantastic, you know. Billy Bremner on guitar is sensational. Nick Lowe's a great bass player.
Yes.
Really, really good bass player, you know. And I think he played with a short scale, and it's got that sound. Terry Williams on drums here. And there's a keyboard player, which I don't know. There's a bit of piano in there somewhere, but I don't think on this track we don't know who it is. But anyway, I just love Dave Edmunds.
Do you know, I've got to say, though, right, so Dave Edmunds is connected to me because of Rockfield Studios in Monmouth, down in Wales. And, of course, he's a Welshman.
Yes.
And you always know those guys that were hanging out. There was it Ray Martinez? He was down there. His brother Paul Martinez was bass player with Robert Plant. So you had all those musos. Dave Charles was a drummer at Rockfield, and Kingsley Ward and all those guys. And they used to be, I remember there was this club that everyone used to go to, like in the 70s, you know, they'd dress up in their flares and go down, and all the artists would go down to this, like, hotel type club place. It was really quite bizarre. But I didn't know, because Cruel to Be Kind, I remember hearing that on the telly. I can't remember whether it was Top of the Pops. So when I bought it on 7-inch, I love that song. I was just looking today as well. Nick Lowe was married to Carlene Carter.
Yeah.
The daughter of June Carter Cash.
And our friend, Monty Hitchcock, manages her.
Yeah.
And we know, I mean, Monty, we didn't see him last time we were over in Nashville last year because he was out of the country. He had a very bad family loss and he was really upset. So he left the country for a bit. Went to St. Bart's, I think he was down, went down on holiday. But we missed him. But he's a great guy, very charismatic, very funny. And yeah. Also a terrible drunk like us. And last time we were together, we had a fierce experience in this Mexican restaurant.
It was so much fun.
And we fell out and we were stripping over the curb. You know, it was a diabolical display.
We talked to everyone, didn't we?
Of British rock and roll buffoonery.
Oh,
The Rolling Stones and... oh, no, it's not. It's Yes. Of course it's Yes. I'm just joking. Going for the one live at Festhal version from the second Yes shows live released in November 1980 on Atlantic Records and the final record before the group disbanded in early 1981. It was the first live album in 7 years. Compiled recordings from the 76, 77, 78 tours in North America and Europe. The mixing and editing was supervised by Chris Squire, who of course plays bass. His bass player is fantastic, but his bass player. It sounds great, you know. And of course, he got the best out of his sound there because he was mixing and producing it. They commissioned the longtime cover artist Roger Dean to produce the artwork, which is cool.
Roger, we've met Roger.
We have. We've met him a few times. He's a really cool guy. And Steve Howe, the guitar player, and I'll talk about it a bit in a moment, wasn't happy with some of the edits and mixes that Squire had done, so production was halted. Anyway, what happened is that it all disbanded and the live album was eventually released in Atlantic Records with the old Squire edited versions.
Yes.
Now, you know, I don't think that Steve Howe's ever heard about crashing vocals because he's playing. Because I always remember speaking to Paul Braddock about Yes. And, I mean, I've been to see him a few times and I do like, you know, a lot of the music. I mean, you know, Roundabout and, you know... Tons of Rough Oceans. Oh, those albums are the great albums. But he is a wittering fool. You know, great guitar player, but he's a terrible witterer. And what I mean by wittering, if you sort of guitarist parlance for somebody going, and on that is a classic case. And he's not just wittering, but he's wittering with a lap steel guitar that he has on a trolley that comes in front of him. And the roadies slide it across like on one of these camera trolleys, you know, when they're doing films. Yeah. So it's like on rails.
Does he walk with it?
No. They put it in front of him and then put it away again. And he's got like an acoustic guitar on the stand that he plays because he's doing about three or four parts at the same time. Great musician, great player. But a wittering fool, nevertheless. And of course, adding to the wittering there was Rick Wakeman in the back with a lot of all that sort of stuff, and poor John Anderson is trying to fight against it. And the the drums and
funny, you know, Yes,
bass came together. Yeah, go on.
I kind of prefer John's voice with John Evangelis personally. I don't know. There's more space for his voice because it suits that kind of style for me better. That's just a personal thing.
Yeah, well,
they've gig so much. I mean, they've had so much success. I mean, it's fantastic. I wouldn't even want to say anything. It's just that, it doesn't quite gelt for me as a, I don't know.
Mm.
Maybe I need to be around at the time. I know
what you mean, yeah. I mean, we don't own one Yes album, to tell you the truth.
No, except for this one.
Anyway, tell us a story about this.
Well, hang on, it's on the floor, hang on. Yeah. So the vinyl that Jeff gave us, the Yes Shows World Tour 1977, which is fantastic. So, yeah, so we've got the vinyl. So we've actually played. We can actually play the track off this vinyl tonight for you. And what was really lovely, actually... Oh, yeah, I've got to tell you about this as well. There's a lovely printed book. I mean, Roger Dean did all the sort of collages and artwork and stuff.
It's a programme, isn't it?
It's a programme, yeah. But it's great because it's like... it's just really colourful, and I do love this, you know, this tactile thing.
Yeah.
It's such a... You hold it, it's tradition, isn't
it? That's the thing, getting a programme at a gig was one of the things, then buying the album and reading the, you know, the liner notes and everything. Anyway, tell us about Jeff's story.
So Jeff, last week, he was so chuffed when he found out, because we didn't tell him beforehand, we just said, listen to the show. And he was so, so appreciative. And anyway, he sent us I call it a digital letter, actually. And he wrote... I was going to tell us a little bit about a story, which is lovely, which really puts the context and perspective into this whole vinyl that Jeff gave us a couple of shows. He said, I'm the youngest of four boys, and two of my brothers are guitar players. So I was exposed at an early age to lots of good music. And my brothers, they had collections of 45s and LPs. And we were the garage for all my brother's bands. And he says, thanks to Mum and Dad for their support.
Lovely.
Isn't that lovely? My brother Tim, he said, started to amass quite a collection of rock and jazz records, primarily based on all the guitarists that he admired and followed. And then I got the bug and started collecting. and hitting all the stores and cutout bins to maximise value and find unique records. And then, he said, I started collecting all kinds of unique albums. He was collecting bootlegs, live radio LPs. Thanks, Jeff. We've got a few of those now. Picture discs, coloured vinyl. Yep, thank you. And would spend hours with Goldmine magazine buying and selling and trading. All with a paper and pen, of course, because that was long before the internet. Lovely. And he said this led me all over the country, hitting the local record shops as well. And the best shopping was always in the Village in NYC with my brother. We found so much great vinyl there. David Bowie. Beat, beat. Fashion. From Scary Monsters and Super Creeps, his 14th studio album, released on the 12th of September in 1980 on the RCA record label. The single of that song reached number 5 in the UK and number 70 in the US. And it was Bowie's first song to chart in America in 3 years. His last hit at that point was Sound and Vision, which peaked at 69 in the charts in 1977.
Right. Now, this, out of all the records that Jeff gave us, all the vinyl that Jeff gave us,
see,
it is my favourite because it's David Bowie.
Yeah.
David Bowie is a king amongst musicians. He's a king in every respect in terms of music in the 20th and 21st century. Incredible. And Jeff gave us a special RCA Radio Series album, Volume 1 of a special 5-volume series featuring Bowie, Bruce Cockburn, Polly Rock, Daryl Hall and John Oates and Ellen Shipley. Who are these people, apart from Daryl Hall, of course? Intended to be played in full as a radio programme, as hype sheet of running times and cues to radio presenters. So it's like it's a fantastic piece of archive. I just love it, you know? Of course, it was originally produced by by Tony Visconti, recorded at the Power Station in New York City and later, see how excited I am, later Good Earth Studios in London. And it was his first album following the Berlin trilogy of Low, Heroes and Lodger in an attempt to create a more commercial record.
Yeah.
And of course they did it. And if you think about the time though, 1980, so it was after it was New Wave, it was absolutely perfect. And here he has the king of his bands. Out of all the bands he's ever had, Dennis Davis on drums, George Murray on bass, Carlos Alomar on guitar, going dick, 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 dick. Very funky. We love Carlos. But the unsung hero of this whole album, and the thing that makes it very, very special to me, is Robert Fripp. Now, actually, with King Crimson, and when you hear him playing on his own, actually, you know, now, I know some people out there are going to get, Michael Inman particularly, is going to be very upset about this, but I don't actually get his guitar playing, because I don't think, individually, when you listen to him play on his own, he's not all that great, but in a band, he's fantastic. And the sound he creates on this is incredible. And it's, you know, those, where he puts those chords in, because he uses open tunings, and when it goes, it's kind of a really weird inversion, and it's almost out of tune, and the whole thing's actually a little bit out of tune. And I don't mean out of tune in terms of the tuning of the guitar, I'm talking about not in the pitch of the song. It's like really aggressively against a lot of the stuff.
He's subversive, isn't he?
Incredible. Absolutely incredible. Anyway.
He's like the bitter herb in a meal that makes it taste fantastic.
Yeah, well, you know, that is a great way of saying it. But I'm more than excited to be playing this tonight.
Oh, Joe, when we were kicking lunch earlier, we played it again because it was so, it's so good just to listen to it. And I can't,
because when you hear David Bowie talking, being interviewed, he really is great, you know.
Yeah, he really is. And just to think that in those days, you know, the way you did a promo was you pressed vinyl of the, you edited up an interview, put the tracks in, and then sent out the vinyl to all the radio stations.
Amazing.
I mean, talk about what a love. So this album then, it's meant to be played as on the radio network in the States, an RCA sent it out. And Bowie was saying in the interview for this particular song with Fashion that when he first started going to discos in New York in the early 70s, there was like this high-powered enthusiasm about it, like it was a natural thing to be doing.
Mm.
But then he said it was replaced by this insidious, kind of like almost grim determination to be fashionable, and it turned into like a vocation.
Mm.
And he said it had then like this strange aura about it, and he wanted to capture that feel in the song.
When I looked in her eyes, they were blue, but nobody street and she can't socialise. Well, I love the little girl and I love her till the day she dies. She wails, humans guitar sound, Genesis scream, waiting at the lights, no one on me. Scary monsters, super creeps, keep me running, running scared. Scary monsters and super creeps, keep me running, running scared.
Un-be-fucking-leavable. David Bowie's Scary Monsters and Super Creeps, the title track from his 14th studio album released on the 12th September 1980 on the RCA record label. Holy shit.
You're very excited.
Still sounds great! Great! You know, and the thing is, you can't get a drum sound like that without a tape machine. It just doesn't sound the same. You know, I wouldn't sell everything and get a tape machine, but we've got to get a 16-track. We've just got to get a 16-track 2-inch. We've just got to get one. Anyway, that's another story. Visconti and Bowie dug in for longer, more considered recording process. That's what they did during this. They were experimenting. You could hear it, you know? And again, Robert Fripp, all over that track, with just a great guitar. I don't know where it comes from. It is totally unique. You know, and I said, you know, I don't get him as a solo, you know, when he's playing with Toya and all that, because he doesn't sound very good, but you get him on this. I mean, that's guitar going, it's like, it's crazy, crazy. And that riff in the lick in the middle, like, dee, 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 dee. I have no idea where that's coming from, because it's not jazz. It's not jazz, and people say, oh, well, he's a jazz, but it's not jazz, it's something different. And I don't know what is going on in his head or what went on in his head during this, but he made this record. And the sad thing was, he wasn't really credited on it, you know, because David Bowie took all the credit, as usual, and Visconti, and nobody talks about Robert Fripp. But I talk about Robert Fripp because he made this record. The songs are great, the production's great, but without Fripp, this would be half the record it is.
It's like the dissonance, isn't it?
Oh, shit, it's great.
I totally agree
I'm
with
so
you,
excited this, you know? I'm so happy that Jeff gave us this record. You know, anyway, that's it. Right, you carry on now. I've done enough.
No, I love it. Yeah. This is the whole point with the Supertone show, though, is like that, you know, it's date night for us, but we have a chat about music, and you know, I love it when you chat about music because we're both really passionate about it, and I get to learn things, you know, and research it. So it's just fascinating for me. And I've got to say, I'd read something in The Quietest today, and I want to read it to you because I don't think I ever really understood the context of where this album was at the time.
Mm. He had three albums that weren't real commercially successful.
No. And so, but there's stuff that I discovered, and I thought, well, you know, I don't want to, actually, I just want to read it. It's only a minute or so, but it's just, I just learned a lot from this. He was saying that.
Before you carry on, I've just got to apologise for the noise. We're getting a lot of noise tonight, and because Bob's moving around under the table, one of our Labradors, bumping the mics, we've got the windows open, and there's like a lot of traffic outside, and I don't know why, because it's a bit hot, so we've got the console on. So I just apologise for a bit of the noise. So there's a bit of background noise and banging and crashing. It's not us. We're trying our very best. Anyway,
yeah,
carry
on.
We're sat
in the Supertone studio, which is a place where we make music, so I guess it's a... sometimes these things happen. But so talking about Bowie, staring down the barrel of the 1980s, David Bowie faced an uncertain future that blurred feelings of optimism with old reflexes of fear and dread. Jumping off from his golden era of music, Bowie had enjoyed a breathless run of 11 studio albums across a 10-year sprint. And in the 1970s, Bowie lived by distraction, recording one album ahead before the last one was even released. I didn't know that. The further he accelerated forward, the greater the weight of musical history accumulated behind him. And shifting from struggling singer-songwriter, glam superstar, plastic, soul man to kraut rock, crooner and arch experimentalist, by 1980... Bowie had already lived several lifetimes of creative reinvention. He should have been confident and secure in his career, but his internal critic continued to edge him into a deeper sense of doubt and self-questioning, and he would have to draw on new reserves of energy to keep pushing himself onward, to relentlessly merge old forms into something different, managing to exist outside of the mainstream while producing a consistent flow of hit singles to support each album. And faced with the great unknown of the imminent new decade, Bowie felt like he was starting all over again.
Well, yeah, rest in peace, David Bowie. We love you.
Coming.
Clapton. Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. I love that song. That's from his third studio album. There's One in Every Crowd, released in March 1975 on the RSO record label.
Recorded shortly after 461 Ocean Boulevard, of course, which we have, features a style very similar to this, but not as commercially successful. And actually, it's my least favourite of all the Eric Clapton records, but this song, it typifies to me what it's all about. That guitar in the middle, you know, that slightly wide. I think it's going to be an auto-wire on there, actually, with the slide. It's a nice solo, you know. But he wasn't very confident about his voice, because I think later on he had a nosedive after this, because he and Tom Dowd was producer, the great Tom Dowd, you know.
We love Tom Dowd.
And the band is the same band that did EC Was Here, because after the drug and alcohol dependency, because during this record it was very, very difficult because he was really in a bad way, you know. And it was Carl Radle, the bass player, who convinced him and Matt have pulled him out of this situation and actually got him back on the road again. EC Was Here, that live album, which is probably, in my eyes, it's the best album he's ever done. Fern on the Road, you know, Rambling on My Mind, all those great tracks. And of course, Yvonne Elliman's on this as well.
Of course.
The great Yvonne Elliman. I just love, you know, and that whole EC Was Here era was after this, and it was beautiful how Carl Radle coaxed him back from this very dark pit in which he was in, and getting him back. But you listen to this, he wants to be J.J. Cale. He wants to be the band. That was his sadness. He wanted to do that, and he could never be. He wanted to join the band, you know, because Robbie Robertson, and last week, because one of Jeff's vinyl records was Last Waltz. I played that last week, and, you know, with Eric Clapton, he's doing Further the Road, I think. Great, you know, but he wanted to be that, and I think it was that sadness and stuff. Anyway, I don't actually know, but that is the what I surmise from the situation.
Well, I've got to say thank you, Jeff, because this is a signed by Eric Clapton version.
Wow.
And I really appreciate that. Also, Marcy Leary was on backing vocals as well. There was an authenticity there, which I really loved. And I've got to say, Carl Radle, right? I get asked a lot whether or not, you know, who are the bass players that really influenced me. And when I started playing, was it 8 years ago now, when I asked you, you know, who's out there? Because I'd never really, I'm more into the song, always have been. I don't really know bass players particularly. And Carl Radle was the one guy from EC Was Here. When I listened to what he did with the bass, the way he was like, I imagine this river and all these stepping stones, and he took the bass places that I never imagined it could go, and the counter melodies, and the way, I mean, it's really quite complex. He had such a natural gift for writing bass lines, and his playing was sublime, and he's one of my big influences in terms of bass playing.
You can hear it when you're playing.
I really love that guy, and there's Jamie Oldacre on drums.
Yeah. The mighty Jamie Oldacre.
I know, talk about it.
The shuffle master, you know. Yeah, fantastic. And I think it's time just to mention today that you got a Vibes article out today about your bass playing and the fact that you've been featured in No Trouble magazine again with a huge feature and video, which is amazing. And I'm so proud of you for doing this, because in these few short years of being a bass player, you've actually achieved worldwide notoriety, you know. Oh yeah, and I know, you know, you're not John Paul Jones in terms of people knowing you, but what you do in this studio with our records is just as good as John Paul Jones for me. Anyway, you carry on about what Jeff said.
Well, I can't see to reply to that. Just looking at you, grinning, going, I don't believe you just said that.
You carry on.
So we're talking about Eric Clapton. So we're talking as well. So this whole show, this second show, is about the vinyl that Jeff gave us. And I just wanted to finish off the story as well, because he wrote us a little letter just telling us a little bit of the context of how this all came to be. So with the presence with Jeff, and we learned about his growing up with the music and how he became this avid record collector. And I always think, you know, your friends and if you're, you know, if you have family, you know, they influence you, of course, when it comes to music. So then, years later, Jeff, he decided to move to Portugal. And he knew that one of the hardest things to do was to part with his record and music paraphernalia connection. So he writes, it had to be the first thing to let go of. And in selling it, he said, you never get what you think it's worth. And at the end of the day, it's more important to try and pass it on to another kindred soul that would love it as much as he did. So what he did, he said, he went through this process. He first isolated his collection to stacks for friends and family and stacks of very rare and collectible items. And that left the bulk of 1,500 albums to sell. And this is a lovely story. And he said he found the perfect place to sell them during COVID. One of his favourite local music establishments was the Poorhouse in Raleigh, NC, North Carolina. You know that type of place? It's like a hole-in-the-wall music venue, and it's been there forever and has music every night where many headliners today got their start. And struggling as they were all were at the time, he had the foresight to have recently opened a record shop above the venue upstairs. And so selling his collection to the venue, he was able to help them stay afloat and at the same time leave behind a thumbprint of sorts, you know, that would linger on in his community, the community that he was about to leave. And he said, this greatly reduced my separation anxiety and put me at ease with the journey I was about to embark on. Sell it all and move abroad. Why not? Ha-ha.
Thanks a lot, Jeff.
Make a mountain out of people's home. Oh, well, oh, well, oh, well.
Led Zeppelin, When the Levee Breaks. And that's from their fourth studio album, which I'm sure you know, Led Zeppelin 4, released on the 8th of November in 1971 on Atlantic Records. And Jeff has given us a pink, kind of purple, curd vinyl version. Thank you, Jeff.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a great album. We're very proud to have this final release because I think we've got four copies of this record now.
Treasured.
Of course, that is one of the greatest drum sounds that's ever been committed to tape, as it was then. It was Andy Johns who recorded that on the Rolling Stones mobile, using a Benson Echo Rec delay, and that drum sound, it's put through a Benson so that you hear it, doo-goo. It's like, it's not Bonzo playing it, it's the Echo Rec that's playing that. Recorded with two Beyer M160 microphones hung from the balcony in Headley Grange. I know so much about this record, I could do a whole show on this one track. You know, and the thing about that, though, and not a lot of people speak about it, is that, now, bearing in mind, there's two microphones up high. Now, what's the loudest thing you hear on there? It's the kick drum, it's not the snare. And yet, the snare always picks up. You'd always expect the snare to be the loudest. So Bonzo must have been absolutely whacking that kick drum like hell. It was a huge kick drum, and it was a brand new Ludwig kit. You know, the drone guitars, because it's an old song, this. It's a blues song, you know. And Plant modified the lyrics. Page and John Paul Jones, lover John Paul Jones, one more of your favourite bass players.
Actually, yeah, another guy I studied.
Retained a very similar riff, but that sort of metronomic, modal,
drony.
Shit, that sounds good. Still sounds good. Still excites me, that record. Just like the David Bowie records. I am so excited tonight. I just love this show. Dave Edmonds to kick it off with. I just love the whole show. I just love, love, love. So thank you very much, Jeff, for giving us this vinyl song.
Yeah, that's the end of the show, actually.
No, there we are. Yeah. Oh, shit, I've talked too much here. So, anyway.
We haven't actually mentioned, but Starlight One, our third studio album, is now officially released.
Yeah, that's right. Not available on streaming anywhere. It's only available exclusively on Bandcamp.
Yeah, we're doing that to put the value back in music as well.
So really, you can listen to it a few times, but then you've got to buy it. And also, of course, it's out very shortly on 180-gram vinyl.
Milky clear. We've had the Lacquer's Cut at Abbey Road in London, and John Astley, he's mastered it. You produced it. I mean, we're so excited.
And there's a UK tour very shortly.
Yeah, come and see us on tour in the UK. Check our website. It's starlight-campbell.com.
And check us out on Vibes as well, which is our blog. See you next week.
See you next week.